Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody? Welcome into another edition of The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Hope you're all having a great evening. It's another week, and it's time for another sit down. We have a huge, huge show for you today. We are 11 episodes in, and I got to be honest, this could be the biggest. You know, and it's a guy today that we're going to talk about that I think society, America has always had this illusion of. But I think when you ask people about him, they don't know that much. So I think it's time to maybe dispel of what you do or don't know about Scarface Al Capone. We could agree, you know, anyone that listens to the show, you can make the case that he is probably the most recognizable figure in the history of organized crime. I think there are a couple questions, though, to pose as we get into Al Capone. Was he a gangster? Was he a mobster? That's something to be interested in. And there's just a lot to look into. You know, the comparison between him and John Gotti, I think, is very similar. And we'll get into all that. Let's bring in our great and esteemed co-host. This guy's getting a lot of love for his great takes on law and different things. It's our friend Blackjack Fletcher. Blackjack, how you doing? Good to talk to you.
I'm fantastic, brother. Glad to be here again. Glad to have another episode going. And this one is a big one, man. I mean, listen, you talked about it, right? Like Al Capone is, if there's a Mount Rushmore of guys who are in organized crime, he's on it. Now, you brought up the point about, you know, there's, I think you can make the case, and I think we'll get into this in a lot of depth, that the legend may outshine the man. In this case.
Yeah, I've always thought that. I think, you know, when you look at Al Capone, it's, you know, was he a really smart guy? Yeah, I mean, he was. I think he really kind of knew the right people. I think he was lucky that he was involved really when there was no mafia. There was no established group. It was basically splinter groups that were gangs that, you know, if Al Capone, Blackjack, was, you know, kind of during his heyday in the 40s and 50s, I don't know if Al Capone would have been much of anything. No. I think he was lucky that there was very little assembled group and you know, he was able to find to connect with the right people. He had great connections and look, life is all about connections. So we'll get through all of it. We'll go through his life. We'll kind of also, I think, dispel of the rumor of the Untouchables, which is one of the fakest movies in the history of movies. It's a very good film, but I think it's important that to understand Elliot Ness was not really the sole reason that the Untouchables got to Al Capone. The federal government, the president, and everyone that was in high esteem in law enforcement really, I think, took it personal with Al Capone at certain points. And,
yeah,
you know, we've said it time and time again, you know, when you continue to spit in the face of the federal government, they're going to come back on you, and they're going to come back on you with every weapon that they can muster. And, you know, we'll get into that and kind of how it all went. Yeah. But, you know, I think it's also one other thing that's interesting is I think when you look back on crime, and Al Capone was born in 1899. So we're talking about basically 120 years or so since Al Capone was born. And I think it's safe to say at this point, Blackjack, can you argue that Chicago is not the most dangerous city in the history of this country as far as just the sheer violence up until today that we see? We saw gang wars in the 20s and in the 10s and in the 30s and up until basically present minute. It's pretty incredible.
I think you can. I think you can definitely make that argument in a very cogent way. And I think a lot of people from Chicago might be offended by it. But I mean, the reality is, you're right. Obviously, you've got the Capone era at the turn of the century, the early 20th century, you know, even going back to Upton Sinclair when he wrote The Jungle, talking about, you know, bodies being dumped in the Chicago River, you know, and then into the 70s, right, with the race riots in Chicago during the Democratic National Convention and how the Daley family had a stranglehold on that city. And, you know, there was constant violence between the people and the police. And to today where, I mean, listen, Chicago is an incredibly dangerous city today. Obviously, there are parts of the city that are beautiful, right? I mean, listen, I've spent time in Chicago and absolutely loved it. But there are other parts of the city where I wouldn't step foot in.
I think there's a real dark underbelly, and I think you're if you're aware of corruption, there's been a bad scent of it for a long time.
Yes.
And that's a lot of cities. I mean, you know, really wherever you are. But let's get into it. It's a long one, and it's an interesting one. Also, before we do get into that, I want to thank all of the great listeners that we have, all the people that are checking out the show. If you're new, thanks for checking us out. Make sure you tell your friends. Make sure you tell anyone that you think might enjoy it. The key to growing a show is word of mouth, right? Getting it out there. So we thank all the great people. This is slowly but surely turning into something that I'm pretty proud of. So this is a big one. Obviously, we know everybody knows who Al Capone is. And we'll kind of ask at the end, you know, is Al Capone the most famous of gangsters ever? Let's get into it. In 1893, Gabriele and Teresa Capone sailed the shores of the Atlantic, got into Brooklyn, emigrated to the United States from Italy, where they had eight children. One of those was Alphonse Gabriel Capone. He was born on January 17th, 1899. By this point, when the Capones came over, there was a wave of immigrants from really everywhere in the European area that were coming over, whether it was Ireland or, Italy or wherever. And they were settling in New York. A lot of Italians are settling in the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and that's where the Capones first lived. During kind of Al's childhood, it was a big family. His father was a barber. He was trying to earn his living in America. And I think whenever you would come over, your goal is to provide for your family, maybe get them to a nicer place. And that's exactly what happened. Al's father was a high level guy. He was a good guy. And he had a pretty good job. His mother was a seamstress. And they saved up enough money when Al was 11 to move the family to a nicer part of Brooklyn over in Park Slope. And yeah, that was big because the Navy Yard at the time was a glorified ghetto, frankly.
Yep.
Right on the water, really kind of poverty stricken. And there were a ton of people in a small little area on Navy Street at that point. So it was nice to see Al kind of get to a better area. And that's kind of the goal. Like I said, when you come to America, providing for your family. Al's family is interesting because they had eight children. It was a big family. And it's interesting to look at how the certain boys in the family went one way and ones went the other way, right? So Al and two of his brothers, Frank and Ralph, both went into the gangster lifestyle. But weirdly enough, one of Al's brothers, Vincenzo, was so disgusted that he actually became a prohibition agent in Nebraska and actually changed his name completely to kind of get away from the stain of the Capone name. So, you know, it's interesting, Blackchick. I'm not sure I know of, at least from guys that we've talked about so far, of law enforcement individuals outside of the mafia cops, but law enforcement individuals that had, mobster brothers. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, for sure. We definitely haven't encountered anyone who had law enforcement in their own family. But listen, when you have a family of eight kids, people are going to choose different paths. It's just odd that three of them went into, you know, an organized crime lifestyle, and the other one decided to change his name to Richard Hart and become a prohibition agent in Nebraska.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because back in those days, you know, you either became a cop or a gangster, I think, a lot of the time. So you went one way or the other. At five, Al would have started attending school. He would go to PS 7 in New York, and he showed some promise early on. He was a smart kid, according to his mother, but he had a behavioral issue. And I think back then, you know, there wasn't like giving a kid, oh, he has ADD or ADHD.
No.
Al may have had that, but Al, by the age of 14, would become a real behavioral issue. He was expelled from school in sixth grade for hitting a teacher, and that'd be the last time he'd ever attend a class, really, as far as elementary or junior high. He would work odd jobs around the neighborhood, including a bowling alley and other places. By this point, he'd taken up sports. He was playing some semi-professional baseball by 17. And he starts catching the eye of local street gangs. He would, throughout his early teens, join gangs like the Bowery Boys, which, you know, were just ragtag young kids committing petty crimes and things like that. But around this time in New York, with the wave of immigrants coming over, there were things like the Black Hand, but there were also no mafia. There was no established Cosa Nostra as we know it. It was basically big time street gangs. And one of the most powerful gangs in the history of New York City is the Five Points Gang. They were assembled by a guy called Paul Kelly. Paul Kelly would, in retrospect, really set the stage for the modern day mafia and would have a mafia-like organization. He basically ran every vice in Lower Manhattan, whether it was bookmaking, loans, extortion, and they even owned Tammany Hall at the time. Tammany Hall was a society and a political organization in New York that basically made decisions and was the political machine of the Democratic Party. So this was a mafia-like organization run by Paul Kelly. And it was really, in America, the first known real organized crime. And it really would set the stage and create people like Meyer Lansky, Lucky Luciano, Johnny Torrio, Al Capone. All these guys were at one point part of the Five Points Gang. And it was really the first big time criminal syndicate in America, Blackjack.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think a lot of people are familiar with the name Tammany Hall, but you know, you described it kind of perfectly. It was an organization that controlled the city of New York's government for a long time. I mean, really a very long time, well into the 20th century. And yeah, what Paul Kelly was doing was, you know, you had street gangs, right? And street gangs are one thing when they're kind of controlling a little bit of territory, but Paul Kelly really expanded this into an organization. And that's kind of, as you said, it was the blueprint for what we would later see in the Five Families in New York.
Yeah, by this point, Al is mingling and meeting all sorts of young hoods in the neighborhood where he meets an older guy named John Torrio. Johnny Torrio was a member of the Five Points Gang. He was running all sorts of rackets for the head of the group, Paul Kelly. He would also meet a guy called Frankie Yale. They were both gangsters in the Five Points Gang. And Yale was a guy that was a known hitman. He was a guy that did business for the Five Points Gang. And he owned a bar on Coney Island called the Harvard Inn. It was kind of an interesting name. It had nothing to do with Harvard educations. It was just a bar for hoods and gangsters and a place to go and have a drink on a night or whatever. And that's where Al Capone would first really be influenced by not only Johnny Torrio, but Frankie Yale. Al takes a job at 17 where he's a bouncer. By this point, Al's a pretty big guy. He's about 6 foot, 180 pounds. He was a strong kid. They called him Big Boy. He was a tough guy. He was known to not take shit from people. And Frankie Yale knew he could use Al probably not only as a bartender, as a bouncer, but probably to do some things for him if he needed to. At age 19, Al Capone marries, after meeting May Coughlin, he marries her. They have a son later that year. They were quick to the draw, Al and May. They had a son, Albert Sonny Capone. And later in life, Sonny Capone would actually become deaf. And that was something that if you know anything about Capone would very much try to care for his son. I think initially he didn't quite understand it, but like anything in those days, it was hard to understand that kind of stuff. But Al would try to get him the best of care throughout his life. By this point, Al's regularly working in the bar at the Harvard Inn when something really terrible happens in Al Capone's life, and it would live with him for the rest of his life. Al Capone is one night at the Harvard Inn in 1917. He's working the bar, doing his thing, when a young gangster that's part of Joe Masseria's crew walks in called Frank Coluccio. Coluccio arrives with a woman he had been seeing and his younger sister. Capone basically notices the young sister. Capone was obviously very known to be a womanizer. He enjoyed having sex with women that were not his wife, and that would really be a long time thing you would have to deal with. But he sees the sister, and within earshot of everyone in the restaurant, he spots her and basically tells her that, you know, honey, you got a great ass. And that infuriates the brother Coluccio. Yeah. Coluccio at that point says something to Capone, and Capone responds with, hey, I'm only kidding. It was a joke. that point, Galluccio grabs a knife and slashes Al Capone in the face. And Al would have a scar the rest of his life, and that would lead to the name Scarface, which you didn't call Al Capone Scarface to his face.
No.
That was something he hated. It was a nickname that he was not proud of. Al Capone did not generally search out trouble. He was not a troublemaker. The problem Al Capone had, and this would be a long-standing problem for Capone, was his mouth. That was really the thing that did him in. I think you can make the case early on, Al was a bit of a all bark, no bite kind of guy. He wasn't really ever a kind of guy that would fight or be provoked, but he would say shit and it would get him into trouble.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. He's not one of the guys that we've talked about on episodes past where, you know, they're going out at 17, 18 and you know, working the streets in enforcement. That certainly isn't what he's doing. He had an imposing figure. I mean, as you mentioned, 6'1", 180 for a guy in the early 1900s is a fairly big guy. But no, he wasn't going out there seeking this stuff out. But as you said, when you're associating with these kinds of people, and you've got a mouth that, you know, you can't control, trouble's going to find you one way or the other. And it seemed to find him pretty frequently.
Yeah. And by this time, Johnny Torrio had left New York to go out to Chicago. He started working for a guy called Big Jim Colosimo. Big Jim Colosimo was basically the Italian crime lord in Southside Chicago. And John Torrio was related to Colosimo through his wife. Colosimo's wife was John's aunt. So there was a connection there.
Mm-hmm.
And John would go out there after Diamond Jim Colosimo needed some help running his rackets. Colosimo was just, he made a ton of money. I mean, this is a guy that really owned every brothel basically in the city.
Yep.
He was a big time gambler. He had a ton of gambling dens and he was making a lot of money. So he asks after the Black Hand tries to extort Colosimo, he asks his nephew, basically John Torrio, to come out to Brooklyn. At this point, Al Capone is starting to wear out his welcome in New York. He is, though, starting to learn a lot from the Five Points Gang and people like Frankie Yale. So Capone decides that there's really not a lot of prospects job-wise in New York. So he moves to Baltimore. And this is a thing that's not really known about Al Capone. He moves and takes a legitimate job for an accountant in Baltimore. He realizes after his father dies that he's got a big family. He's the man of the family. He's got to start, you know, kind of contributing to his mother, his own family, and his brothers and sisters. So Al contacts his old friend, John Torrio, who invites him out to Chicago. And in 1919, Capone leaves New York and goes out there. Now, again, at the time, it's still pre-Prohibition. And yep, the only rackets at this point were, you know, the drug game is not important. It was really gambling and hookers. That's what, yep, and that's where the money was made. But a big day happened on January 1st, 1920. And if you've ever seen Boardwalk Empire, which I want to mention a little bit at the end of the show,
yep,
is if you haven't seen it, I'd highly recommend. It really tells the story of a young Al Capone and kind of his rise. It doesn't get into a lot later in his life, but I thought it was a really great picture. It talks about Big Jim Colosimo and Johnny Torrio and everybody. But as we know in that show, on January 1st, 1920, the Volstead Act is basically put out there. And it's in America, the law blackjack that says you cannot legally buy or consume alcohol anymore. There was a lot of pressure, as you know, from women in America, from a lot of people in America, that alcohol was bad.
Yeah.
So the government at that point decides, and you know, now we think of that as kind of wild, but back to the Volstead Act, I think we could all go back and say the creation of the mob had to do with the Volstead Act.
1,000%. I mean, without any shadow of a doubt, the Volstead Act, Prohibition, completely created an entire underground industry. Because, I mean, listen, let's be real here. You know, as much as we talk about this country as being a secular country and we have a separation of church and state and all that, this country was founded with fairly puritanical values, right? I mean, we were kind of uptight, and in many ways we still are when you compare us to you know, maybe European countries and things like that. And yeah, there was a growing wave of concern about what alcohol was doing to people in this country. So they passed this act, but the real effect that it did, and you know, Jeff, we can talk about this. You and I have talked about drug laws on this show.
Yes.
Passing a law saying you can't do something isn't going to stop people from doing it. It's only going to create criminals where they may not have been before, right? Like, it's the same thing with gambling. It's the same thing with drug laws. People are going to do it if they want to do it, and they're going to find a way to do it. And it was the same thing with prohibition. People that wanted to drink were going to find a way to do it. And now you created a cottage industry of people to supply that demand.
Yeah. And in places like Chicago, which we talked about at this point, is very corrupt. It always has been corrupt. And young people like Johnny Torrio and Al Capone and Arnold Rothstein and Lucky Luciano and all these guys around America knew that, you know, once prohibition happens, it was almost celebrated because the organized crime at this point knew that it meant big money.
Money to be made.
Keep in mind, at this point, Al Capone is 20 years old in 1919. And basically at the turn of the 1920s, he's still pretty young. He's out in Chicago. He kind of starts out as a bouncer and a bartender at a brothel that Big Jim Colosimo owns. Big Jim Colosimo at this point basically has restaurants up and down South Wabash Avenue in Southside, which was a pretty big thoroughfare for brothels and things of that nature. He operated something on 2222 South Wabash called the Four Deuces, and that's where Al Capone would work. And interestingly enough, when Al Capone first came to Chicago, John Torrio would basically tell him, go outside, and if you saw a man walk by, you'd say, hey, fella, we got some real nice women in here. And he would direct them to tell those individuals to come in. This would also be a hangout for prominent Chicagoans, visitors, and a pretty popular destination because Jim Colosimo was a big-time gangster. He kind of would remind you of, if you've ever seen Godfather 2, early that Don Fanucci character, he kind of had that mustache and he was kind of a fat guy. And the problem that Big Jim Colosimo would deal with is once prohibition happens, he's in a bitter divorce, Colosimo. And keep in mind, the divorce he had was to John Torrio's aunt.
Yep.
Johnny Torrio was not particularly happy. And Colosimo made it clear he's an old school guy. He does not want to get into bootlegging. It's kind of like how Angelo Bruno in Philadelphia didn't want to sell drugs. Young guys are aware that bootlegging is going to turn into big money. And Johnny Torrio realized that the South Side and all of Chicago was there for the taking, and they could be the architects like, you know, Arnold Rothstein was in New York in the Midwest. And Colosimo was very stubborn. And in 1920, Colosimo not only has a divorce, but he, a month later, elopes with his new girlfriend, Dale Winter, and they honeymoon in Indiana. Upon their return, John Torrio
said no one ever.
Yes, weirdly enough. I guess at that point it was a hot spot to go to. I don't know. But Johnny Torrio is already making his move. He decides, fuck this guy. He's not my family anymore. He doesn't want to get rich, and he's okay with just earning what he's earning. And at that point he was making a lot of money, but you know, John Torrio knew there was a lot of money in alcohol. So he decides that Torrio's got to go. Torrio decides that Colosimo has to go, and he calls his old friend, Frankie Yale, who travels from New York to Chicago, and him and Al Capone basically rub out Colosimo. Colosimo would be asked to come by a restaurant, and at that point, in broad daylight, in front of people, Al Capone and Frankie Yale murder Jim Colosimo. Jim Colosimo is gone, and John Torrio takes over basically the Italian-American triumvirate of the organized crime in Southside Chicago blackjack.
Yeah, which obviously is good news for Capone because, you know, we've talked in a lot of these episodes, Jeff, that usually when you get into this life, there's a guy that brings you along, right? And for Al Capone, that guy was Johnny Torrio. So having Johnny Torrio in a position of power means nothing but good things for Al Capone on the horizon.
Yeah, and you know, Al starts making moves. He starts killing people. He starts becoming bigger and bigger. And when Johnny Torrio took over operations, he was pretty much the underboss at 20, 21 years old.
Al Capone, it's a hell of a rise.
Yeah, it really is. And this would obviously mean more money for Al Capone. In 1923, he would purchase a home on South Prairie Avenue in Park Manor, Chicago, on the South Side for $5,500. He would move his entire family out to that home. Now, during this time that he's kind of coming up, learning the rackets, becoming the underboss of the Torrio family, per se, something bad happens to Al Capone. He was known to be a womanizer. Look, when you work at a brothel, it's hard to not sample the goods, I'd imagine. Al starts sampling the goods and he contracts syphilis. Like any young male, he decides, I don't care, I'm young, I'll be fine. And he gets no treatment for it. And remember that, because that would be something that would bother Al Capone for his entire life. Throughout the early 20s, Al Capone would start killing people. He would kill anyone that got involved with the Torrio bootleg beer business. And what he started to do, and Torrio started to do, is set up operations everywhere. They start setting up shipping routes throughout Canada into Chicago. And basically, all the area was controlled by them on the South Side. They'd also start heading into other areas like Cicero, Illinois, Chicago Heights. Now, it's important to understand, in Chicago at the time, Torrio and Al Capone ran South Side. The North Side was run by a group called the North Side Gang. The North Side Gang at the time was run by a guy called Dino Banyan. If you've ever watched Boardwalk Empire, he was in that show.
Yep.
He ran with a guy called Jaime Weiss. And it's interesting because Al Capone was noted as saying many years later that the only person he was ever scared of in his life was Jaime Weiss. And these guys would go back and forth for really their entire life. There's three central figures that Al Capone beef with: Dino Banyan, Jaime Weiss, and Bugs Moran. They were all big time enemies of his. They were all Irish and or Jewish. And that's important to discuss because for Al Capone, if you know anything about Al, whether you were Irish, Jewish, Italian, it didn't mean anything to Al Capone. They just happened to be his enemies at the time. So that's kind of how the lay of the land looked in Chicago, and everyone was fighting. Now, initially, Johnny Torrio realizes this and says, look, here's what we're going to do. This is huge for all of us. Everyone can make money. North Side, you run the North Side. We'll run the South Side. Everybody's happy. Everybody's good. Capone would have a rising star. He would be a rising star in the business. And it was now time to start reeling in money from bootlegging. And look, they started making connections. Johnny Torrio starts making alignments with people back in New York. He still had a lot of ties there, whether it was Arnold Rothstein or Joe Masseria or whoever. There was a ton of money in bootlegging blackjack. Think of it like the drug trade today.
Yeah. I mean, listen, we've talked, you know, about the edict in the Italian families in New York, you know, deal and die, right? Like that, that was the old school edict. But why did guys still go and take the risk to do it? Because of the immense amount of money that was in it, right? Like there was a ton of money in it. And it's the same thing with bootlegging. People wanted their booze and they were willing to pay for it. And if you could provide it, you set your own price.
Yeah, that's exactly right. But what would happen is, obviously, the North Side started to feel that the South Side was getting too much. And, you know, people like Dino Banyan started to basically hijack South Side beer shipments and then sell them back to owners. And that's where things would kind of start. And that's where the beer wars would kind of, you know, kind of go. Chicago police in 1924 would assist the Northside gang in robbing several distilleries, which had been under federal guards at the beginning of Prohibition. So, you know, Dino Banyan was also known to be very close to the cops. He would throw lavish parties for police officials and politicians. Look, you paid people off in Chicago. It's pretty simple at these times. And, you know, Dino Banyan was slowly going back blackjack on these peace agreements that were set up. And Johnny Torrio and Al Capone started to get really furious about all this stuff. And it made for kind of wars to start. There was big money in bootlegging, as we continue to say. And that would also really set the stage for, at least initially, the end to Dino Banyan. In early 1924, there was an alliance that O'Banion tried to set up through Torrio and Capone, but then almost immediately, Dino Banyan would, through really a schemy decision, go back on everything. And what happened was Torrio would lose patience after Dino Banyan tried to sell him a brewery. So Dino Banyan and them set up a meeting, and he's supposed to meet Torrio at the brewery to sell them the brewery to kind of make peace. In May 19th, 1924, Torrio's there inspecting the property, and all of a sudden the police show up. And it's found years later that Dino Banyan kind of set it all up to kind of get Johnny Torrio out of the way. Torrio is absolutely furious. And Al Capone and Johnny Torrio realize Dino Banyan is not playing ball. He's a shiesty fuck, and he's got to go. He's just, he's not playing ball, and he's not willing to speak or talk about anything. He's going back on his word. We've got to get rid of this guy. And this would be the real beginning of the war between the Northside Gang and the Chicago Outfit run by Johnny Torrio. Yeah. And on November 10th, 1924, Dino Banyan owned a flower shop called the Schofield Flower Shop. Three unidentified men walk into the establishment and kill Dino Banyan. And that would really be a five-year war that would ensue. But Dino Banyan had to go. He was a real shiesty fuck.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you know, we talk about greed being a common denominator in a lot of these stories. And this is a great example of it, because there was enough to go around here. Chicago's a big town. You know, there was a demand for the product. There was enough to go around. You could have split the territory up and had peace and had everyone kind of looking out for each other and being on the same boat. Instead, you know, it was, I want it all. It's all mine. And what happens, Jeff, in any mafia story when somebody says, I want it all? It puts a bullseye on the back of your head. And you're going to get it at some point. And O'Banion did.
Exactly right. Just before the Dino Banyan stuff went on, there was a big change in Chicago. In 1923, a guy named William Deaver was elected mayor of Chicago. And that would put a lot of pressure on people like John Torrio and Al Capone and other gangsters in the city. Deaver was a guy that wanted to put pressure on gangsters and basically make them leave Chicago. He was a tough on crime type of mayor. And this is when Al Capone realizes that, you know, Johnny Torrio is getting older. He's starting to be less and less involved. But to escape not only Chicago, which I can't necessarily control. Now, Blackjack, it's important to understand at this point how powerful Al Capone and gangsters were in Chicago. It was said at one point that 50% of the police in Chicago were owned by Al Capone and the Outfit, which is pretty incredible. I mean, think about that. A city the size of Chicago, I would imagine this day and age probably has 30, 40,000 sworn. I don't know how many they had in 1923, but I'd imagine that's a lot of people, man. And to have that many people basically being bribed, you were going to get away with a lot of things. And the election of Deaver basically tells Capone that he's got to get out of Chicago. So he moves his organization, at least his part of the organization, into Cicero. John Torrio would still be in the South Side, but Al Capone would head to Cicero, Illinois, which is still part of Cook County, but it's more of a suburb. And it was a great place to go because it, like Chicago, was pretty corrupt. It was a small town, but there was very corruptible people. And it's actually where Hawthorne Racetrack is, which Al Capone would have a ruling interest in years later, as far as the gambling in that area. But it was a great decision because Bill Deaver was not going to be shaken down. He was going to try to eliminate Al Capone. And when Al Capone went into Cicero, He also believed that this would help in shielding him from people like Jaime Weiss and Bugs Moran. It'd be harder and harder to get to him. The problem for Al Capone was he had to start completely over. He had to start fixing elections. He had to start getting control of the city with the town council. And he had gangsters there that were going to try to upend him. In Cicero, there were gangsters, William and Miles O'Donnell. They would fight with Capone over their home turf. And the war between the Chicago North Side and the O'Donnells would result in about 200 deaths over the course of a 4 or 5 year period. And around this time, it's also important to realize that the machine gun had been kind of given to America, the Tommy gun, if you will. And that would start a lot of problems. So kind of fast forwarding it to 1924, Al realizes that he needs to fix the town council election in Cicero to get power and to do what he has to do. So he starts threatening polling station with thugs. He starts going to cemeteries to get dead people's names to vote. And he wants to be in control. So he elects that his brothers, Frank and Ralph, kind of be in charge of that. The problem is there were police officers in Chicago in Cicero that weren't willing to just allow this to happen. And this would be where tragedy would first strike Al Capone's family. During a riot in a polling station, Frank Capone, Al's brother, is murdered. And this would be the real kind of tragedy that would affect Al a lot. And I think Black Chick, when you look back at his kind of early life, particularly in the early 20s, this was a big thing. I mean, Al Capone was very close with his family. He moved all his brothers out to work for him, the ones that wanted to. And losing a brother like Frank, I think, really set him into becoming a real lunatic that didn't really think a lot anymore.
Yeah, I mean, and if you think about it, right, it kind of makes some sense. Because first of all, he's still a very young man, right? He's still in his 20s. He's, you know, gone out to Chicago, moved halfway across the country. He's brought his family with him that is willing to go with him. He's obviously very close with these two. And now in trying to set up kind of his own thing, one of them gets killed. It's hard for him probably not to blame himself on some level. And it's hard for that not to harden you as a person. Just on a personal level, that weight is going to make you hard. And it's going to make the decisions that you make moving forward more calloused than maybe they would have been prior to that.
Yeah. And that would be, as I said, the first real tragedy to strike Al Capone personally. During his rise in Cicero and in Prohibition, Al Capone was involved with bootleggers in Canada, and they would really smuggle liquor. And that was really the starting off point for a lot of whiskey and things of that nature. Yep. A journalist once asked Al Capone if he knew Rocco Perry, who was the basically public enemy number one in Canada for bootlegging is concerned. Al Capone would reply, "Why? I don't even know what street Canada's on."
I love that quote.
So, you know, he would frequently visit Canada, and he had some different kind of stash houses, if you will. But there's no evidence, according to the RCMP, that Al Capone was ever in Canada, but I'm sure he was. In January of 1925, Al is very happy, at least as happy as he can be after losing his brother. Keep in mind, he does win the mayoral election in Cicero, and basically controls Cicero at this point.
Yep.
But it, again, came with a heavy cost, but he owned Cicero, and that was important. Some things would happen, though. In 1925, in January, Al Capone is ambushed by the Northside gang. He's left shaken but unhurt. So there was kind of the first assassination attempt by Jaime Weiss and Bugs Moran. Under 2 weeks later, Johnny Torrio returns home from a shopping trip, and he's in his driveway where he shot several times. Luckily, his wife's nearby, and he recovers and survives. But he realizes at this point, Johnny Torrio, that it might be time to retire. Johnny Torrio, by this point, is kind of a beaten man, if you will.
Yep.
He had kind of schooled Al Capone in how to run his organization. I mean, he's pretty old at this point. I mean, he's in his, not necessarily old, but in gangster terms, if you lived into your 40s or 50s, you're pretty old.
Yeah, especially this time. Right. Yeah. Right.
So he realizes he had been at this point. One of the things that I always found funny about Boardwalk Empire is they got a lot of things right about most of these guys' real life. And in that show, they paint Torrio as kind of a lazy guy that, you know, always kind of diverted his things to everyone else. He would go on a lot of vacations. He'd always go to Italy. So I think John Torrio kind of realized, I have a ton of money. Let me let my protege kind of take over. And I'll still act as kind of a consigliere in a way to him. Yep. But I'm going to kind of take myself out of it because I want to live the rest of my life in some sort of serenity, if you will. So in 1925, early February, Johnny Torrio retires and puts Al Capone in charge of the Chicago outfit. So, I mean, at this point, Al Capone's 26 years old and in control of one of the largest criminal syndicates in America.
Yeah, he is now running an international criminal enterprise, right? Because he's using Canadians to smuggle booze across the border. He's in charge of a huge enterprise when, if you think back 10 years earlier, he was playing semi-pro baseball and working in a candy shop. So the come up for Al Capone was rapid by any standards.
It really was. I mean, it's rare you see, kind of someone, and again, these were different times, but it's rare to see someone that young kind of grow up that quick.
And in a city he's only been in for 5 years.
Exactly. Torrio would essentially hand all of Italian organized crime to Capone, which is, you know, pretty incredible, as we have continued to say. During this point, Al Capone was making inroads in not only Cicero, in Chicago. Al Capone was doing a lot as far as, and he would do a lot really in the mid to late 20s into the 30s. He would help a lot of people. He enlisted the help of local members in the black community to kind of help jazz musicians in that area. I was a big fan of jazz music, and he once requested clarinetist Johnny Dodds to play a number that Johnny Dodds did not know. He split $100 bill in half on a table and told Dodds that he would get the other half when he learned that piece. He would also help young black pianists and jazz folks to get road trips and things like that. So he was doing some things in the community. He would arrange soup kitchens and all sorts of stuff. He was really kind of turning into a figure in America that the common man liked and looked up to. They couldn't relate necessarily to his suits and cigars and food and cars and things, but he gave back and he provided something to the people of Cicero, to Chicago. And in a way, at this point, people loved Al Capone, right? He was kind of a larger than life figure, but he would take care of them.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the comparison to John Gotti at the beginning of the episode. And this to me is the comparison, right? If you asked John Gotti's neighbors in Howard Beach what they thought of him, they loved him. Yeah. They would say, John's the most generous guy we've ever met. John throws these lavish block parties. And, you know, if we have a problem with our family, John's there for us. This is the same thing, right? Al Capone was a guy at a tough time in America, right? The 20s was not an easy time in the United States. No. Al Capone was a guy who kind of embraced community in a way that a lot of others didn't.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously things are going well for Al. He's making a ton of money. You know, by this point, he's a very rich man, and he would indulge. He was a very flamboyant dresser. A lot of people would always rave about Al Capone, the way he dressed.
I've seen
some really interesting things. They're pretty old, but of people that knew Al Capone, you know, in his heyday, you know, dancers and things of that nature. You know, they would always say he was always very complimentary to people. He would always, you know, be nice to people. He'd always give them something if they needed it. There was a story one time that Al was at a club and he spilled a drink on one of the waitresses, and he got wind of what happened and he ran into the waitress and gave her $25. And at that point, that was a lot of money. And Al basically said, "Hey, go get yourself a new dress. I'm sorry for what happened." He would be asked about his activities, and his favorite response always was, "I'm just a businessman giving the people what they want. All I do is satisfy a public demand."
Not wrong.
And I think he looked at what he did as People are going to do it, as we kind of alluded to here, and that, you know, whether it was, you know, drinking or having sex with individuals, Al Capone realized that he was just someone that satisfied something that people wanted. The problem was, the continued assassination attempts on his life would keep up. On September 20th, 1926, Al Capone is ambushed outside of Cicero near Hawthorne, and he survives again. But this, again, has him shaken. The problem was, Jaime Weiss and Bugs Moran were ratcheting up attempts to eliminate Al Capone. They wanted him gone, so they would go to his headquarters at the Hawthorne Inn and basically fire Tommy guns at the windows of the first floor restaurant. Capone was unhurt yet again. He got very lucky, and he wanted a truce. Al Capone did not want to get into a war. I think at the end of the day, he was scared of Jaime Weiss. He knew Jaime Weiss was a loose cannon, but Jaime Weiss said, no, fuck that. We're not relinquishing anything. Al Capone would be the first one to get to Jaime Weiss. On October 11, 1926, Al Capone was done dealing with Weiss. He would basically set up an alliance with certain folks and eliminate Jaime Weiss. Weiss, to the end, was an interesting guy. He was quoted as saying once that, I don't expect to live long, but I expect to live long enough. and look, that was kind of the growing thought, that if you were in the if you're in the business of crime, by 30, you're going to die. Biggie Smalls once said that. I think a lot of people, I think he said at one point he was surprised, or maybe it was Tupac, that he surprised that he lived past the age of 20. Jaime Weiss and his men were crossing State Street to enter a shop when two gunmen hidden in a nearby rooming house opened fire with a submachine gun and shot Weiss and a bodyguard, Patty Murray, and they were both killed instantly. So that was that for Jaime Weiss. Capone's biggest, one of his biggest nemesis was gone. He could breathe a little bit easier. One thing Capone would, though, become increasingly worried about is security. And he wanted to get out of Chicago. He knew that Chicago was a place where, you know, you're not going to live forever. Look at Torrio. Look at Jaime Weiss. Look at Colosimo. You're going to go one of two ways. As a precaution, he and his entourage would randomly show up at train depots, buy an entire sleeper car, and just go to different towns in America. He loved to get away, including places like Kansas City, Cleveland, Little Rock, and Hot Springs. He would also spend weeks on end in luxury suites under assumed names. He would also buy a $20,000 limo that was bulletproof and weighed 7 tons. He became obsessed with security, and he had to be. He had no room for error. And in 1928, a little bit later, Capone would actually buy a home in Florida from August Anheuser-Busch, which if you know anything about beer, you know that name. He was a beer magnate at the time. He paid $40,000 for a mansion on the Biscayne Bay between Miami and Miami Beach, which I would imagine was a beautiful place.
Still is. Palm Island. Beautiful little island in Biscayne Bay. And yeah, he got a house that is still there to this day. And it's a beautiful little house. Little. 14 rooms. So not small by any stretch. But yeah, the distance. He clearly wanted distance between himself and Chicago whenever he could get it.
Yeah, and keep in mind, he had one more person to deal with, and that would be Bugs Moran. And that would be the kind of biggest event of Al Capone as a gangster, which we'll talk about in just a second. It was also important to note that Al Capone would never register a property in his name. In fact, he didn't even have a bank account. He would always use Western Union for cash delivery. And you'd have to imagine he had a lot of mattresses with a lot of money under him. He had safes everywhere. It was always, he was always doing stuff in reconnaissance. It was pretty interesting. As I said, there was one more gangster that Al Capone needed to eliminate, and that was Bugs Moran. And Bugs Moran proved to be, I think, probably the toughest individual to get to. But one thing I wanted to talk about, Cicero, Illinois, was starting to sour a bit on Al Capone. And a lot of it had to do with a guy by the name of Robert St. John. Robert St. John was a writer. He was actually the editor of the Cicero Tribune, the newspaper in that town. And I have to say, Robert St. John was a tough dude. He was always willing to report the news. Think about that today, Blackjack. You know, most people aren't going to take a bullet for reporting news.
No.
Robert St. John would. He would write scathing articles about Al Capone and Al Capone's gang. Al didn't like that. He wanted to be looked at as Robin Hood, and he was great, and he wasn't going to put up with Robert St. John. So at that point, he instructs his brother Ralph Capone and several hoods to go take care of Robert St. John. So Robert St. John's walking out of the newspaper building one day. He's accosted by Capone's brother and several others. He's repeatedly beaten with clubs, baseball bats, and one of the new methods the Capone gang used was a soap in a sock. And St. John would talk that if you hit somebody in the back of the head, in the neck, down by the bottom of the head, you could kill somebody with the soap. It's kind of like a lock in a sock, which we talked about with Whitey Bulger, but that was a favorite of the Capone gang. They would use that in a wool sock and really, really bother people with it. So, you know, Al's kind of doing things now, and this would go back to his kind of brother, where he was kind of doing stuff that kind of turned him into a bit of a lunatic. You know, we're kind of reckless, frankly. Also in 1926, Al would attempt to kind of in killing Northside gang members. He actually kills a guy called Bill McSquiggan. The problem that Al would have, and this really set in motion, I think, the beginning of the end for Al Capone. Bill McSquiggan was a U.S. attorney, an assistant U.S. attorney. And Al Capone realizes that he fucks up pretty bad here. And to this point, nobody could make a case on Al Capone. Al Capone would be arrested randomly, but he literally would pay people off. He had people so scared that they wouldn't even appear in a jury. And he had lawmen kind of in his pocket. So doing anything to put Al Capone behind the wall wasn't successful. But when you start killing people that are assistant U.S. attorneys, people start noticing and really kind of realize the lawlessness that was going on. Al Capone realizes this and flees. He goes to Lansing, Michigan, where he lives with a former girlfriend. He waits for a while when the heat dies down, but he still ends up surrendering. Again, though, no indictment. There was no proof. There was no proof that Al Capone did anything, and Al skates yet again. So that was, Blackjack, a lot of thought and reason to bring Al Capone to justice, but nothing ever stuck.
Yeah, I mean, listen, you've got to realize when you're talking about a crime like murder in the 1920s, there's no DNA, there's no fingerprints, there's no cameras, there's nothing like that, right? So you need to have an eyewitness. You need to have somebody there who saw it happen. And I don't think there was a ton of people lining up to testify against Al Capone in the 1920s. He was one of the most famous people in the country, period. And everyone knew what he was. So I think that, yeah, there's reason to believe that he would skate on a lot of this. But, you know, we talked about this with Carmine Persico. We talked about it a little bit with John Gotti about Rudy Giuliani. If you're going to go and kill a member of the government, it's not going to make them go away. It's going to make them double down. They are going to redouble their efforts, and they are going to find a way to get you. Come hell or high water, they will ultimately figure out a way to do it.
Exactly right. And we'll talk about that here in a second. There was one more thing that Al Capone needed to do in kind of completely taking over Chicago. We have to remember that Al Capone, once he kills Jaime Weiss, kills Dino Banyan, you know, he's in control. He has multiple locations under control, including Chicago. It was said that Al Capone was truly untouchable at this point, and he was bringing in an excess of $100 million, his organization. Think about that, Blackjack.
That is
1928.
Yeah, it's an unfathomable amount of money.
I mean, he was truly not only one of the most influential people in America, but I mean, ever, maybe? I mean, at least in Chicago.
The money's not real at that point, right? Like, that amount of money today is staggering. In 1928, it's not real, right? Like, it's literally, you have unlimited money. Like, there's nothing you can't buy.
I mean, considering, put it this way, in 1928, $1 million today would be worth about $16 million. So we do 100 times 16. I mean, we're talking about $1.6 billion.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a Fortune 500 company.
Yep.
I mean, a very high-level company. That's how untouchable Al Capone was. It was going to take a mammoth effort. Al Capone would have his final shot. And this would set up a truly historic event. In 1929, Al Capone orders that Bugs Moran has to go. And he sets up a situation called the St. Valentine's Day Massacre in 1929. Basically, as I said, the goal was to kill Bugs Moran and other rivals from the North Side. What would happen was at 10:30 a.m. on February 14, 1929, seven men were at a garage on 2122 North Clark Street in Lincoln Park, Chicago. There were four men that walked into the garage. Two were wearing police uniforms. The others wore suits, ties, overcoats, and hats. The police-uniformed men led the other men at gunpoint to stand against the wall. They included Bugs Moran, Albert Kachelik, Adam Heyer, Albert Wieneshank, Fred Guzenberg, Peter Guzenberg, and two others, including a guy called John May, who was a mechanic for the Moran gang. And spotted as well was John May's German Shepherd, weirdly enough. She was underneath a car. At that point, all seven individuals are shot and killed, including Bugs Moran. The only mammal to survive was that little dog underneath the car. In fact, John May was gone. Bugs Moran was gone. Everybody in the garage was gone. And that, weirdly enough, though, one of the individuals, Frank Guzenberg, somehow was still alive. They thought he was dead, but he was stabilized for a short time. Police would try to question him. He sustained 14 bullet wounds. The police would ask him who did it, and he replied, "No one shot me." He died 3 hours later. So that just goes to show you the kind of people that you're dealing with back in Chicago. They were not willing to give up anything. So all the people that are on the first 48, you could take a book out of some of these guys' book. They could be shot 14, 15, 20 times, and they weren't going to say nothing. Al Capone was widely assumed to have been responsible for the massacre, though he did have an alibi. He was at his Florida home at the time of the massacre, so there's no way it could have been Al Capone.
Of course not.
So Al Capone would evade any problems here yet again. But by this point, in May of 1929, things would start to go another way. Al Capone had all the money, he had all the power, and he had Chicago basically in his grips. But he had to start fighting another group, and that was the federal government. Al realized that, you know, there were still people that wanted to take him out. He realized that he was kind of a marked man, and he was kind of undergoing a bit of a legal quagmire, if you will. And by this point, I think he kind of realized that the feds were starting to figure things out with him. So he kind of sets up some travel. He goes to Atlantic City in 1929 to the Atlantic City Conference. And it was a pretty big event, Blackjack. Do you know much about the Atlantic City Conference?
I don't.
The Atlantic City Conference was something that was set up in 1929. And think of it like Appalachian, which was done in the 50s and 60s with gangsters. But the Atlantic City Conference was kind of a summit of organized crime members. And it was held in Atlantic City. It was kind of to deal with business. And it was kind of a syndicate meeting. All sorts of people were there, including Johnny Torre out of retirement, Lucky Luciano, Frank Costello, Joe Adonis, Vito Genovese, the Masseria family, including Albert Anastasia, Frank Scalise, Vincent Mangano, Tommy Brown, Lucchese. I mean, anyone who was part of the mob controlling interest, sure, was there. Also, Meyer Lansky, Bugsy Siegel, Louis Buchalter, Oney Madden, and our good friend Nucky Johnson was there as well, who is actually a real person, for anyone who doesn't know. Chicago is represented by Alphonse Capone, Frank Nitti, Jake Guzik, Frank Rio, and other Southside Capone gang members. So this was a big-time thing. A lot of people were there. This would have been a great thing for the police in this country if they were able to figure that yep. thing out. But they were not. So he's traveling there. Al Capone gets jammed up in Philadelphia for a weapons issue, carrying a concealed weapon. And he has to spend some time in Eastern State Penitentiary. Mm-hmm. Around this time as well, Al has an issue. And he has an issue not from the government, not from rivals, but in his own cohort. In 1929, Al realizes that Frank Rio, Albert Anselmi, John Scalise, and Joseph Junta, all people that were part of his crew, the goal was to depose Capone and take over his rackets and get rid of him. Capone figures this all out. And this is actually immortalized if you've ever seen The Untouchables. Remember, yep. Blackjack Capone has everybody around a big table and he just starts beating on that guy with a baseball bat?
Yep.
That was this scene. And this would also kind of go back to the whole, you know, really disturbing individual claim that Al Capone had become. Al Capone was kind of losing the plot a little bit. He had to do what he had to do, but he was doing some really disturbing things at this point.
Yeah. And again, you know, these are traits that we've seen before, right? Like there's one thing in doing what you need to do, as you said, to consolidate power, right? Like those are things that sometimes you have to do. There's another thing when paranoia starts to creep in, right? And we've seen this with a lot of guys. And you start to look over your shoulder and think everyone's out to get you. And you start to become unhinged. And you start to kind of lose any sorts of connection with reality. And that becomes a very dangerous person. And everyone around you notices it.
Yeah, so, you know, Al Capone is killing his own men. And look, this is where the beginning of the end happens. After the St. Valentine's Day massacre in 1929, the Chicago Daily News publisher Walter Strong, he's kind of had it with lawlessness. And he realizes that no one in a position of power in Chicago is going to do anything about this. So he calls a friend of his, pretty important guy named Herbert Hoover, who was the elected president. He was about to take over the job from Calvin Coolidge. And he wanted, I think, come in with a mandate on crime and eliminating organized crime, I think, was near the top of his list. So Walter Strong contacts Herbert Hoover and says, look, the lawlessness is out of control here. Kind of like it is now, in a way, and says, look, Hoover, you got to do something about this. You've got to come in because they're paying everyone off here. You need to bring in people that are not going to be paid off and they're not going to, you know, kind of fold and do something about this. So he arranges a secret meeting at the White House, Herbert Hoover. And just after 2 weeks after the inauguration, he kind of sets things in motion. Strong is joined by Frank Loesch of the Chicago Crime Commission, and they make a case to the president that, look, something has to go on here because, according to them, Chicago was in the hands of gangsters and the police and magistrates were completely under their control. The federal government was the only force by which the city's ability to govern itself could be restored. And they basically made a really compelling case to agents that and to the president that something had to be done. At that point, Hoover believes it, and he launches a multi-agency attack on public enemy number one, Alphonse Capone. Not only was the Treasury Department involved, but the Justice Department was as well, and the IRS. Keep in mind, there was no ATF at this time, so that would kind of be the governing bodies. They would develop plans. Instead of going after Capone for murders or extortion or stuff like that, we are going to figure out a way to take Al Capone down. And the way was, let's get him for income tax evasion. And they would attack an elite. Yep. They would create an elite squad known by many as the Untouchables. Now, popular culture would believe that Elliot Ness was in control, but yeah. Elliot Ness was actually in control of just bootlegging and stuff.
Yes.
The real people were the ones kind of behind the scenes that were taking care of things. Elliot Ness led the bootlegging operations, correct, which down the road would prove kind of redundant. It didn't really matter that much because Al was picked up for tax evasion. So while it's a good movie, it's not really that true. On March 27, 1929, Al Capone was arrested by FBI agents as he left the Chicago courtroom after testifying to a grand jury that was investigating violations of prohibition laws. He was charged with contempt of court for feigning illness to avoid an earlier appearance. So he basically just didn't show up.
Yeah.
And that would kind of lead, like I said, to the Eastern State Penitentiary thing where he would be kind of in trouble for that gun charge. In 1930, he was released from Eastern State Penitentiary, and that's really where the shit hit the fan. In April 1930, Capone would again be arrested for vagrancy in Miami Beach, and the government would order sheriffs to keep him out of Florida. Capone would claim that the Miami police had refused him food and water and threatened to arrest not only him but his family. He was charged with perjury for making those statements because they weren't true. But as usual, Al Capone acquitted after a three-day trial. In September of that same year, 1930, a judge would issue a warrant for Capone's arrest for those charges of vagrancy and then use the publicity to run against the current mayor in a Republican primary. In 1931, Capone was tried on contempt of court, and they would really try to jam him up a couple of different times. Capone would also be linked to a murder of a Chicago police informant called Julius Rosenhelm, and that was never proven either. But this is where things really start to get interesting. IRS leader of the Special Investigation Unit chose to handle Capone, a guy named Frank Wilson. He yep. was charged with focusing on the spending that Al Capone did. And the key to the conviction or getting a conviction on tax charges was proving that Al Capone had income. And the most valuable evidence in that regard was his offer to pay the tax. Basically, him and his brother would be tried for tax evasion. And they would kind of say that they definitely earned the money. They definitely would regularize their tax position. And they would owe the taxes and they had no problem paying them. They kind of would say that they just didn't really know they had to pay tax. And the problem that we had, Blackjack, in America at this point was the fall of Wall Street happens in 1929. Mm-hmm. Americans everywhere were finding ways to pay their taxes. And Alphonse Capone, who was a multimillionaire, would try to make sense that he didn't know he had to pay taxes. And he was willing to pay them, according to his lawyer, for various sets of incomes for various years, including $100,000 in 1928, 1929. Hence, without any investigation, the government had been given a letter from a lawyer active for Capone conceding his large taxable income for certain years. So basically his defense was, Blackjack, I definitely didn't know I had to pay them and I'll just pay them now. So it's not an issue, right?
Yeah. I mean, everyone always says ignorance of the law is not a defense and it's not, and it's a bullshit thing, right? Everyone knows you got to pay taxes. I don't care if it's the '20s, the '30s or today, everyone knows you have to pay tax. The Supreme Court made it very clear in 1927 that even if your income is gained illegally, it is still income and thus taxable. So Capone's defense didn't hold any water. And as you pointed out, the timing here is critical because we are in the throes of the Great Depression. And Al Capone went from being sort of this, as you said earlier, Robin Hood type figure to being really a villain in the eyes of most Americans, because it's like, dude, you're sitting on millions of dollars. We're standing in a bread line, mm-hmm. and you can't pay your taxes.
Yeah, it really That's didn't look good optics-wise for Al Capone. On March 13, 1931, Al Capone is charged with income tax evasion for 1924 in a secret grand jury. On June 5, 1931, he's also indicted by a grand jury on 22 counts of income tax evasion from 1925 through 1929, and he's released on $50,000 bail. A week later, consequentially, Elliot Ness and his group of untouchables inflicted financial damage on Capone's operations and led to his indictment on 5,000 counts of the Volstead Act. Now, I know that sounds really great and interesting, but at the end of the day, the untouchables were kind of like second best, if you will.
Yes.
Because while it did damage Capone's finances, it really didn't do much to convict him on much of anything. But again, it's a great film. Kevin Costner's great. Sean Connery's great. On June 16, 1931, at the Federal Building in Chicago, Capone pleads guilty to income tax evasion and those 5,000 violations as part of the Volstead Act. And he negotiates a 2.5-year sentence after he plea bargains, which you got to think is pretty damn shrewd by Al Capone. You know, he basically commits 6-ish years of tax evasion throughout his criminal life in Chicago, and 5,000 counts of the Volstead Act violations, and he gets 2.5 years. Not so fast, though. In July of 1931, Judge Wilkerson refuses to honor the plea bargain, and Capone's counsel rescinds their guilty pleas. On the second day of the trial, Judge Wilkerson overrules objections that a lawyer could not confess for his client, saying that anyone making a statement to the government did so at their own risk. And he also deemed that the 1930 letter to federal authorities could be admitted into evidence from a lawyer acting for Capone. So Capone had basically got fucked at this point. And this is where the government was going to throw the book at Capone. They would look at witnesses. They would look at ledgers. They would look at everything, and that would imply Capone's control rather than stating it. Capone's lawyers would rely on the plea bargain, and it ended up not working. And Wilkerson would allow spending to be presented at a great length. They would go through all of the income Al Capone had, the way he spent on lavish things. Yep. And they would charge Capone with evasion of $215,000 in taxes on a total income of just over $1 million during a 5-year period. Capone was convicted on 5 counts of federal tax evasion on October 17, 1931. So think about that. During a 5-year period, Al Capone basically earned about $16 million, which that's a ton of money.
It is.
At the end of the day. And he was sentenced a week later to 11 years in federal prison. He was also fined $50,000 plus about $8,000 for court costs, and also had to pay back all of his tax debt, including interest. The contempt of court sentence was served concurrently. So Al Capone would be going away for 11 years. And at least on the street, that was the end for Al Capone, Blackjack.
Yeah, I mean, listen, 11 years, we talked about, you know, kind of the, not just the life expectancy, but just how things worked back then. 11 years was essentially a death sentence for him. His time running things on the street was over here in an instant.
Yeah. In 1932, at age 33, Al Capone was sent to USP Atlanta. Once he arrived to Atlanta, Capone was officially diagnosed by the prison doctor with syphilis and gonorrhea. Not great for Al Capone. In a few short months, Blackjack, Al Capone went from being worth, I don't know, $20 to $30 million to 11-year prison sentence and gonorrhea and syphilis and no real prospects.
Yeah, I mean, it's over for him at this point. This guy went from leading a lavish lifestyle, running one of the biggest cities in the country, and not just running the crime in that city, running the city. I mean, he had total control, to now dealing with syphilis and gonorrhea, which, I mean, the gifts that keep on giving, right? And being in USP Atlanta, this is a hard and sudden fall from grace.
It really is. Not only would he have syphilis and gonorrhea, but he also began suffering withdrawal symptoms after it was found that Al Capone had a cocaine addiction. And he had a pretty bad cocaine addiction. It was all falling apart for Al Capone. In fact, yep. It had already fallen apart. He had two STDs. He had terrible withdrawal, and he was going away for a long time. His family wasn't able to see him. Not only did he have an addiction, but the addiction was so bad that his nasal septum was basically rotting. He had done so much cocaine by that point. Capone was competent enough, though, to do a prison job of stitching soles on shoes for 8 hours a day. He had a weak personality and was said by fellow inmates that he had a lot of depth issues. He wasn't real competent. He was being kind of bullied in a way. And other inmates worried that Al Capone was basically going nuts. He would really feign insanity, and it was starting to kind of look like that. Al Capone yeah. was slowly withering away. The not doing anything about his syphilis really made a big problem for Al Capone, because when you get syphilis and you don't treat it, it can affect and eventually get into your brain and slowly eat away at your brain. And that's what was yes. basically happening to Al Capone. Capone was receiving special treatment at Atlanta, but it wasn't necessarily enough. And Al Capone was moved to Alcatraz, which had recently opened off the coast of San Francisco in 1934. Interestingly enough, when Al Capone was in Alcatraz, he was in a prison laundry room and he was stabbed by a fellow inmate called James Lucas. James Lucas was a criminal, a bank robber from Texas. He got into it with Al Capone and stabbed him with barber scissors in a laundry area. Lucas was sent to solitary confinement. And after being stabbed, Capone turned and grabbed Lucas and threw him into a wall. Inmates were angry with Capone for not taking part in an inmate strike. So, you know, Al was really kind of reclusive at this point. He wasn't really messing with anyone. And, you know, he wasn't really backing himself up. He was kind of being nope. bullied a little bit. He would kind of serve out his time at Alcatraz. He did get some good behavior, though. He started behaving a little bit, and yep. he started kind of doing what prisoners do. He kind of started easing into prison life. He started playing banjo at the Alcatraz and was part of a prison band called the Rock Islanders, which nice. Would give a Sunday concert for other inmates. And it's important to bring up as well that if you know anything about Al Capone, he actually played the mandolin a lot when he was younger for his son, who was, as I said, deaf. From what I understand, the story about Al Capone, where his son would touch his neck and he could feel the way his neck would move as Al would sing, he could kind yeah. of hear it through that. And, you know, Al was always a big fan of music. As I said, he loved jazz and he enjoyed the mandolin. So I think playing the banjo was probably good for his psyche. He would also transcribe the song Madonna Mia, which is an Italian ensemble, creating his own arrangement as a tribute to his wife and longtime supporter, May Coughlin. At Alcatraz, he was trying to get through it, but his decline would become increasingly evident. Doctors would say that syphilis had completely eroded his neurological facilities. His mental acuity was gone. And syphilis of the brain was made in February of 1938. So Blackjack, he's trying to kind of ease in. He's stabbed. He's yeah. trying to ease in. But as we know, you know, his mistake of having sex with a hooker when he was very young and not doing anything about it. This is where it's almost kind of like nowadays with being overweight or fat or something. You know, you can do it for years on end, but or like smoking or something, it's going to catch up to you eventually. And, you know, being kind of reckless and not taking care of your sexual health, Al Capone was paying for it.
Yeah. I mean, without a doubt. I mean, you know, a mistake that he made as a very young man would ultimately lead to his demise, you know. And you mentioned his time in prison and how he kind of handled it. It's worth noting that this was not a guy who had spent any time in prison, right? Like, we see a lot of gangsters who have spent at least a little bit of time inside. He spent none. This guy went in having no idea how to handle himself, and it showed from day one.
Exactly right. Capone would complete his term at Alcatraz in the hospital section, confused and disoriented, according to reports. And that's to spend out his final year. He was transferred to FCI Terminal Island. Now, I want to make this clear. Terminal Island is still open. In fact, if you commit a crime on the federal level in California, Nevada, Washington, Oregon, and you're a low inmate, going to Terminal Island is not a bad gig. No. It's a pretty nice place. It's right on the bay. They've got some really nice facilities. Michael Franzese talked about Terminal Island. He was actually in Terminal Island. He said it's very nice. It's probably a good place to do time. So Al Capone kind of lives out the final year of prison at Terminal Island, where he serves a sentence for contempt of court. He's paroled November 16th, 1939, after his wife, May Coughlin, appealed to the court based on his reduced mental capability. So that's where Al Capone was at this point. He is not even able to speak on his own behalf. Yeah. And he's kind of a...
He's a shell of a man at this point.
Pretty much. The main effect of Capone's conviction, though, would mean that the thought of him in Chicago was a distant memory. By this point, Frank Nitti had taken over control of the outfit. And this is really where the outfit was created. They took a page out of Capone's book and said, you know what? We're not going to make those same mistakes. They knew that they would be kind of troubled by the police, but that with Prohibition kind of being repealed, they could take the attention away from Prohibition and kind of run in silence. They would also kind of confuse consensus on who was the boss. And Frank Nitti actually did a pretty nice job with the family. Sure. And he kind of handed off control down the road to Paul Rica and Tony Accardo and other people. So Frank Nitti did a pretty nice job. It was a long way from the days of Al Capone and his gallivanting around and acting like a nut job. Due to his failing health, Al Capone's released finally from prison in 1939 and transferred to what he thought would be Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. However, Al Capone at this point in America was someone that people grew to hate. Johns Hopkins actually refused to admit him on his reputation. It's pretty rare that you see that. In fact, I don't think you see it
ever.
At all.
Ever.
Al Capone was pretty much hated by most people at this point, but Union Memorial Hospital would have him in Baltimore. And, you know, he actually, I think in a way was pretty touched that they cared for him, because by this point, Al Capone, like a lot of gangsters, becomes a tragic figure, right? I think he realized that the only people that cared about him anymore was May and some of his family, ones that had been left. He really had nothing. He was pretty much on his own. And I think he was grateful for the care that he received. In fact, he donated two Japanese weeping trees, cherry trees, to the hospital in 1939. And in 1940, a very sick Al Capone would leave Baltimore and head to his home on Palm Island in Florida.
Yep.
In 1942, penicillin is mass-produced, and lucky for Al Capone, he becomes one of the first American patients treated by the new drug. The problem was penicillin was created about 20 years too late for Al Capone.
Yeah.
If it was created in 1922, who knows? Al Capone could have lived to be very old.
Probably would have. I mean, penicillin, the problem is it'll stop what's happening presently, but it can't reverse the damage that's been done.
Exactly. And it was already seeping into his brain and destroying him. So he was kind of screwed. You know, and it's interesting to think about Blackjack. When we think of Al Capone, so it was conceivable to think that if Al Capone never got syphilis, and let's say they had penicillin, Al Capone would probably at that point, he would have been out of the criminal life, right?
I would imagine so. I mean, listen, he got a relatively short sentence. So,
yeah,
you know, he certainly would have had an opportunity at a lengthy life afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, in 1942, he's 43 years old.
Right.
Now, he kind of had to look at it and say, well, I'm pretty lucky. You know, I managed to beat it. I'm good, but I screwed around and I have syphilis and now I'm screwed. In 1946, a doctor and a Baltimore psychiatrist would examine Al Capone and conclude that at age 47, he had the mental acuity of a 12-year-old. So he was pretty much a shell, as we talked about. Al Capone would spend the last years of his life at his mansion on Palm Island, spending time with his wife and grandchildren. On January 21st, 1947, Al Capone would have a stroke. He would regain consciousness and start to improve. But by this point, he had another big problem health-wise. He contracted bronchopneumonia, which is a kind of bronchitis pneumonia mix. In the 40s, that wasn't good, especially when you have syphilis.
No.
It'd kind of be like having cancer and getting coronavirus.
Yeah, right.
On January 22nd of 1947, Al Capone would suffer cardiac arrest. And 3 days later, on January 25th, surrounded by his family, Al Capone would die of heart failure as a result of apoplexy. He would be transferred back to Chicago a week later and would have a private funeral. It was said at this time, the gang leader of the outfit was Tony Accardo. Tony Accardo was once a bodyguard for Al Capone.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll do a show on Tony Accardo down the road. He was a really fascinating guy. He would kind of become the boss and would span 8 decades, kind of in control of you know, various rackets, and then become the day-to-day boss in 1947. But it was said that when Al Capone died, there was a mandate put out by Tony Accardo that every individual that was part of the outfit be at the funeral to pay respects to Al Capone. That's how respected Al Capone was in gang circles. You would hear nothing like that today or in the 80s or 90s. Going to a funeral was a no-no. Al Capone would originally be buried at Mount Olivet Cemetery in Chicago, but in 1950, his remains, along with his father, Gabriel, and his brother, Sal, were moved to Mount Carmel Cemetery in Hillside, Illinois, and that's where he would rest finally. So there you go. That's Al Capone. And I want to kind of end this show with just some final thoughts. You know, Al Capone, it's interesting because I think if you talk to any layperson in America that knows very little about organized crime, I think most would lead to think that they know something about Al Capone. And when you ask them about Al Capone, there's a lot of kind of discredited thoughts, whether they're true or not, that Al Capone was kind of the biggest boss in the history of the mafia. When in retrospect, Al Capone never took an oath. He never believed in organized mafia. There was an organized mafia at this point. And I think Al Capone, sadly, I don't know if he was the most vicious individual in the history of organized crime.
No.
I don't think he looked for trouble, frankly. I think he was forced into doing things. He did what had to be done. But the truth is, like John Gotti many years later, John Gotti and Al Capone were very similar because their mouths both brought them down. And they real quick, one final thought. Al Capone would, I think, push the government to heights that you know, he just couldn't get past. And, you know, whether it was being slashed when he's a young man to just some of the things he did, his mouth got him into a lot of trouble.
Yeah. And I think the comparison to Gotti is a great one because there's a couple of things. First, they are both the stereotypical image in your head of a gangster, right? They both dressed beautifully. They both embraced the role in a way that a lot of guys shied away from. They both were not shy about running their mouth. Like, they are the stereotypes. And that's why I think what you said has a lot of validity to it, that people think they know more about Capone than they do because it feels like we do, right? Like, it feels like we know who Al Capone is. When in reality, Al Capone had a very short reign over a bootlegging industry. And he was a guy who really, you know, like you said, he wasn't that much of a tough guy when he went away. He didn't really know how to handle himself and ultimately literally rotted away. So, I mean, I think, as I said at the beginning of the show, Jeff, I think the legend significantly outshines the man.
I think that's so true. And when you're really looking at that time period, like we've said time and time again, there was really, outside of New York City, there really was, like, Chicago didn't have a mafia. Like, there wasn't, you know, there weren't mafia people. There were gangsters. There are people that controlled gangs. And, you know, when you look at that time, people never talk about Meyer Lansky. They don't talk about Lucky Luciano enough. They were 10 times the mobster 100%. That Al Capone was.
100%.
Now, Al Capone was lucky because he came up worked under John Torrio. Torrio basically hands him the operation, and he makes a ton of easy money through the drug trade. He ends up being really lucky, frankly, with only getting 11 years on all he did. He only got 11 years for it. And it's interesting to think about. At the end of the day, the thing that did him in was fucking a dirty broad when he was 20 years old.
That's it, brother. That's it.
So there's a lesson to all you young whippersnappers out there.
Careful who you lie with.
Cover that thing up, man. but yeah, you know, we always kind of give him the lore of this notorious kind of figure. But and I think it also helps that when you think of a gangster, at least I think most people, what do they think of Blackjack? You know, the fedoras and that's the suits it. And the that 20s kind of image.
That's it. It's the image of him.
Yeah. And, you know, you don't think of, you know, I think now you think of like track suits and gold and shit like that.
Sure.
That was only new. I mean, look at John Gotti. You ever see him wear a track suit?
No. Nope.
Wear suits. And I think that's part of the mystique from Capone as well. But in short and in ending, I think Al Capone was just a figure of his time. I think he's – I'll just come out and say it. I think he's probably the most overrated mobster in the history of organized crime. I was he a fascinating guy? Yes. Was he a powerful guy? Yes. But it came with the territory and where he was. I think if he'd have been in New York, he'd have been chewed up and spit out. He luckily had one connection that worked for him, and that was Johnny Torrio. So there you go. Al Capone on the sit down. That was a great one, Blackjack. We really kind of delved in, I think, to the mystique of who he was. So hope you guys enjoyed the show. As always, you can check us out on Twitter at the sit down 7. I put out a lot of great questions there, throw out a lot of great facts about the mafia and movies and all sorts of stuff. So make sure you check that out. Make sure if you're new to the show, you subscribe to us. Let us know what you think. Leave us 5 stars. We always want to hear your opinion on what you think of the shows and what we got going on. I saw also Blackjack in the comments that maybe certain mobsters aren't real happy with our show. They're posting comments and stuff.
Yeah, Sammy Gravano can kiss my ass.
Well, let's not jump to conclusions. We don't know if Sam sent them, but
I posted a nice comment on his podcast too.
But yes,
eat it, Sammy.
For anyone that don't know, there's been a couple comments kind of talking up how great Sammy Gravano is, and you know, they're talking on our show. So I doubt they know Sam. I you know, Sammy just seems like he's just doing his thing. But if it is actually someone that he knows, well, it's crazy that he actually cares that much. But I guess we are one of the only mob podcasts. So yeah, we're a history show, Sam. Relax.
That's it.
All right. We're out of here. Long show, a fun show. We moved this show up. I was going to put out Anthony Casso, but I thought, you know what? I know this show is going to be so good on Al Capone. We'll put it out. So next week we will do Anthony Casso for sure. So you can expect that. A real lunatic. Definitely one that was more dangerous than Al Capone. So, okay. Blackjack, great stuff as always. You know, terrific stuff from you always. So everyone have a great night. We will talk to you all next week here on The Sit Down. Have a great night. Bye-bye.